So, welcome to episode 200. I first wanted to start off just by saying thank you to everybody who has been on the podcast before and shared your work. Because, you know, I get compliments from different faculty members or some grad students who have really liked the podcast. And to be honest, like, this podcast wouldn't exist if you didn't come on to come share your work. And I've actually ran the analytics on numbers of listeners, and anytime I talk about my own research, it's the lowest listened to episode by far. So it's, I don't know what that says about me, but it does say a lot about you that you are essentially carrying this podcast and sharing this work. I mean, stuff that Ben did over the pedagogy seminar, you know, like well over 10,000 downloads on that single seminar. So like it's really successful, and I'm really open to different ideas from you all. There's some innovative things that you, people have suggested, and we're trying some new things. But today we're going to hopefully have like a casual conversation about the state of health and physical education and HPE research. And so for the people on the call, feel free to kind of chime in anytime. If you want, you can also take that conversation into the chat and then pull from there. Obviously, this is an audio podcast, so the chat doesn't really make for a great podcast. But I know that some people like having that conversation on the side, and then we can bring it in. And if you just want to listen in, you are more than welcome to just kind of listen in. I put into the chat again the questions that we're going to go off of, and hopefully maybe you prepped, maybe you didn't. It doesn't matter either way, but we're going to go through those and see how it goes. If you want to drop out at some point, you're more than welcome to just wave and say goodbye. But let me just... and if you're talking for the first time, unless I like call you specifically by name, maybe introduce yourself and where you're from, so people that are listening that aren't seeing your face knows who's talking. So the first question that I came up with was the most influential or best article you've read and why other people should read it. So I promised to start this off myself, and my choice here, which again is one out of many, was Kim Oliver's Girly Girls Plank and Girly Girls Can Play Games, Las Niñas Pueden También. And I see Mara smiling because this is an article that we read in grad school together, and it was one of these articles that really like exposed me to prolonged engagement with one group. It kind of gave me this courage to do studies with less than 100 people. Like, the end doesn't really necessarily matter that much. She worked with this specific group. It was a small group, and I was so confused because before that I probably mostly read quantitative papers that had to have a specific high number of participants. And you know, it also exposed me to a lot of you know, how young girls don't necessarily, they're marginalized in physical education. And, you know, I've done similar research projects to that. And then it kind of led me to read work by Carla Ligueti and other students, Oscars on here, that have kind of carried on that similar work. So I think she's done a ton of really great work in that area. And I think that that's why I would say if somebody were to read an article, it's a good article to start with. So others, I'll just jump right in. Maybe I called out Mara, so maybe Mara can share.
Sure. Well, you kind of stole my line, but I had a backup one, so that's okay. That was definitely one that made a huge impression on me, but one that I came back to over and over again during my dissertation research, and I still come back to, is by Dr. Anne Flintoff, and it's called Playing the Race Card, Black and Minority Ethnic Students' Experiences of Physical Education, Teacher Education. Because when we look at issues of racism in PE, in the K-12 schools that are, you know, sort of held by teachers, we can see the role that teacher education plays in maintaining systems of whiteness and racism. And so I think that understanding the cycle of teachers, you know, how they see themselves with regards to race, this article did a really good job of that.
Awesome. Others, Jamie.
I can jump in. This is kind of along the same line, so I was sort of waiting for someone else to jump in with something different, but an article that I have my grad students read, and it's something that's informed a lot of the work that I do, is actually by Annette Stride in the UK, Let Us Tell You, South Asian Muslim Girls Tell Tales About Physical Education. And I feel like it is a really important article for us from the standpoint of, you know, listening to diverse voices and things like that. But the fact that in this article, it actually sort of dispels some of the beliefs that we hold, I think, about certain groups of students. And when Annette actually asked them, their perceptions and things were a lot different, I think, than maybe she even, and I, you know, not to, you know, claim what she believed, but, you know, I think that it was, the findings were sort of surprising. And so that one was really great. And I can drop the DOI into the chat too.
Awesome. Thanks, Jamie. Let's go Kevin and then David. So Illinois to Wales.
this is an article that I go back to all the time. It's one that I have my undergraduate students read, actually. It's by Kirtner, Smith, Hastie, and Kinchin, and it's published in Sport, Ed, and Society, and it's called The Influence of Occupational Socialization, Beginning Teachers' Interpretation and Delivery of Sport Education. And what I really like about this article, and of course, you know, this is my bias coming through, of course, I would choose a socialization article. But what I really like about this article is I find that it's really accessible, and it really helps kind of start conversations with undergraduate students about, you know, how they understand teaching practices, in this case, sport education specifically, but you can kind of draw the extension to other teaching practices and how the way that they've been socialized both previously and during their current education influences that. And then things that they can think about preparing for once they move out into schools in terms of facilitators or barriers to effective teaching.
Awesome. Thanks, Kevin. David? So you dropped your citation in already, so ahead of the game.
Yeah, I thought it'd be useful to share. So this one I chose is John Evans, Brian Davies, and Emma Rich's excellent article called The Body Made Flesh, Embodied Learning and the Corporeal Device. It was published in the British Journal of Sociology of Education. And for me, it's a really interesting read on a number of levels. It was one of those articles that I think pushed the boundaries of our thinking around sociology of education and the role sociology of education can play in physical education. I think some of the questions that they're asking around embodied learning and some of the positive but most not so positive consequences of physical education are really highlighted in it. I think it's a really brave article, and it's one that I share with my students because of the way that they articulate complex theory but make it accessible. And I think that's a rare talent in some of the articles that I read. So it's a fantastic article. And I think it's a really good one because it gets me thinking differently about topics that we've thought long and hard about within physical education and not necessarily found solutions to. So yeah, it's a good one for me.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks, David. Kirsten?
Good, I'm Kirsten Petrie. Lots of us have talked about what we read at grade school. We don't call it grade school here, but whatever. One for me was George Sage's paper from 1993, so it harks back a whole lot longer, Sport and Physical Education and the New World Order, Dare We Be Agents of Social Change. And really, I guess as a grade student, it really spoke to me about understanding physical education as part of a broader social system and a socio-cultural kind of understanding of what we do and what we might do differently and moving beyond a sport agenda only, and what that means. And I think it probably informed how health and physical education curriculum in New Zealand has been shaped as a result. So it was way early on, and I'm not sure you still see some of the stuff that he talked about in there playing out and how physical education is presented internationally. So, yeah, I think it's just a nice introduction into some of the discourses that shape our practices.
Yeah. And I wonder what makes a good article for you all. Like, we talked about all these different topics, and I think David brought up a good point of, like, he said it was just, like, a good article because it made you think differently. And I think that, for me, that's what Kim Oliver's article was to me. It made me think differently about what I thought I understood, and it totally, like, changed my understanding. And I think that, to me, and you all can kind of agree or disagree or give a different point, but to me, like, what makes a really good article is that it changes my thinking. It changes what I thought before, and it has to be that, like, kind of drastic. And I think that that's why, for me, when this article that made such an impact was when I was in grad school, is because I just thought I knew things, and I definitely did not, and it changed that way. So would you agree with that, or do other people have another article that they would want to share? Go ahead, Oscar.
Okay, well, the article that I want to share with you all is it's from Bill Landy, Towards a Queer Inclusive Physical Education. When the first time I read it, coming from a male-dominated culture where everything has to be, male has to be, I mean, supposed to behave in certain ways, when I read it, it was like, just blew my mind. It changed my perspective on how should be an inclusive physical education, and how, as we as teachers, we need to include everyone, despite whether you are agreed or disagree with some behaviors, and you have to be put yourself in a different position to understand all the struggle your students might have been through those type of challenges. And and it was really hard for me to read it because, as I said, coming from my culture, where talking about these topics are not as open as in other countries, it just changed and created, I mean, a certain inner struggle within my personal identity, my teaching identity, and how a researcher can apply all this new knowledge into my courses as well. So it was one of those articles that it changes your perspective on how things should work.
Yeah. Thanks, Oscar. And Oscar came on, he's at the Autonomous University in Chihuahua. Yes, correct. All right. So he's in Mexico, and he came on and did a similar podcast that I did with Kirsten about New Zealand, Oscar did about Mexico. So there's interesting kind of correlations there. And I like that you brought up Dylan's article and placed it in reading it coming from a very different culture. Joanne, I'm not sure, I know you're in transit, but did you want to speak about that at all?
Yeah, sure can. So I've highlighted Emma Enright and Mary O'Sullivan's paper from 2011, which is the first part of the title is Can I Do It in My Pajamas? I'm in my car, so I don't have the full reference. But as you were all talking, I was thinking about papers that resonate with me, but also ones that I keep coming back to and ones that I share with my students. And for me, the Can I Do It in My Pajamas paper is something that I often share with my undergraduate students who are not training teachers, but they are going to be probably going to go into teacher education in the future, as a real example of how we can do critical pedagogy, we can do a negotiated curriculum in the classroom. What does it actually look like in a HPE situation? So we're taking these concepts of being critical or wanting to challenge existing practices, and they go, well, what do we do instead? And this is a really good example of how you can actually implement things day to day, as well as like a broader, like if you've got a unit of work, how you can implement things longer term as well. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. And that's a great article as well. Great one to read, especially if you're looking at student voice and getting, you know, listening to the people who you're actually teaching about what you're teaching. So I'll keep that question open. So for anybody that wants to come back, or you're kind of thinking about an article you want to bring up, feel free to either just drop it in the chat and say that you don't want to talk, or just raise your hand. But I'll move on to the second question, which is about what are we not paying attention to now that we'll be kicking ourselves in 10 to 20 years for missing? And I put this question up there because I've been thinking about these futures papers, and obviously like what we're thinking about now. So like if I bring a topic up, somebody's written a paper up about this, someone's commented on this in some way. So I don't think any of these are going to be necessarily original ideas. But what I've seen at least tend to happen is that we go back and say, oh, this person predicted this in 1993 or 2016, and now this is happening, but we didn't really take action. So with that in mind, I think one of the things that in the US that needs to be fixed in some way is high school physical education, the secondary level. So 9, 10, 11, 12, I feel like the two places, especially the first place I was at, we had a hard time finding really good high school placements. So when our students did their secondary observations, they often did it at the middle school level, so grades 6, 7, 8, instead of going to the high schools. So, you know, this week in our in my master's class at Mason, I have the students think about how they can restructure something in PE and give their, they do like a little short video. So my video is about restructuring high school physical education to be, to have three different parts. So part one is PE as it is, you're not changing anything. The people who want to come in, they're coming into ninth and 10th grade PE, doing the stuff that normal PE teachers do. Number two is changing that, or so you have three options. So the second option is doing it hybrid. So using the unused gym space in the morning and the outdoor space when available, or outdoor education stuff when available, or the gym space after school, you use that space for PE. You open it up during lunch. You have a hybrid, kind of like a flipped classroom. So students can do their physical activity portion wherever they want or however they want, but the curriculum is a flipped classroom. And then the third idea, or the third option, is to do fully online PE. And this is for the students who absolutely hate it. They don't want to be there. They're maybe disruptive in class, or they just like refuse to participate when they're going in. So again, it's like, it's something that I've kind of thought about of how to do it. It would need a lot of community support, community engagement to open up those spaces. But I think that there's a lot of public spaces that are free. And if you take, let's say you have physical education in third period, middle of the day, you don't want to sweat, you could do your homework during that time. And then, or you could leave, move physical education to the last period of the class and go into a community space to be physically active during that time, instead of staying in class, getting sweaty, and then going right into another class without, in the US, without showering. So that's kind of my restructure idea. I don't know if that's the best idea, but I went first, so save me a little grace. Jamie.
I think that the big thing that we need to be paying attention to that we don't do as good of a job as we should be in higher ed is policy and policy research and policy being policy actors. I feel like we talk about it a lot and we say that we should do it and be interested in it, but that there's not a lot of action around policy and things like even what you're talking about with the restructuring. All of that connects back to policy at some level. And so I think that we're at this place where I really feel like we sort of know what works and what doesn't, not always, but that the next step is for us as higher education professionals to start to engage more in the policy realm, whether it's through policy action and legislation and being involved in that in our various levels, or through policy-related research.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think that if you look at the U.S., the policy research is not at the same level as it is in Australia or even the U.K. So I think that that's something in U.S. specific for sure, that we haven't really pushed a lot. And Hans came on to the podcast and did part a policy discussion, and he talked about how at the assistant professor level, it's just not prioritized. Policy work takes time. You can't pull off a really quick survey and then end up getting published in order to go up for tenure. So the research lines don't start early enough, and then people who are getting into policy are perhaps getting in late. And also, some of the best policy that works is going to working with specific congresspeople or members of parliament, and that doesn't necessarily lead to a publication. It might lead to a lot of change, but it doesn't lead to the stuff that people in the universities are getting promoted for. Others, about something that we should be paying attention to. Colin, go ahead.
Hi, Risto. Thanks for having me, first of all. Yeah, I didn't really want to come and add mine, but I wanted to give you a bit of support for yours, really, especially on the back of what you said about your podcast. Your research might not be as well listened to, so I wanted to come in and say you've got a good idea there. It reminded me of some of the ecological work that's happening, possibly in sport more than PE, people like Keith Davids or Chris Button or James Rudd, where they're really trying to connect PE to the wider environment and taking it out of the classroom, taking it out of formalized sports halls and into the community. And then just to the comment after about sport policy, I think actually the connection there between the two of those areas, that idea of, well, it's a great idea to take PE out into the community to prepare people for the natural environment that they'll inhabit for the rest of their lives. But what are the policy implications of trying to do that, and what policies would be needed to be in place to enable PE teachers to do that? So just when the two ideas came up there, I see a connection between the two, because otherwise you're left with the lone wolf PE teacher trying to affect the pedagogy on their own, an ecological pedagogy that's broader than just the school, but without a policy framework to support that and encourage that, it's pretty tough ask. So yeah. I just thought those two were really nice connections there, and I wanted to come in and back you up and say, yeah, I think you're onto something good. So I'll stop at that point and hand over to somebody else.
Thanks for that. Really appreciate the backup. I need it. Clancy.
Greetings, everyone. Long time no see, Risto. But first and foremost, congratulations, my friend, on your 200th episode. This is a fantastic accomplishment. And Colin said it well. It speaks to your passion and your commitment to the profession. Well done, my friend. And you know, the previous question and then going into or segueing into this question, I think relates. I kind of held back at first, but I wanted to jump in, and I think I'm going to jump in now and basically say that when we think about articles or research or literature that is a must read, many of the people in the room today would certainly apply. You know, congratulations and kudos to all my colleagues. You've done some outstanding work. But one thing that I wanted to, or one author that I wanted to bring up that I think many would agree, that I would encourage anyone to read, whether it's a teacher candidate in their beginning years of the profession or even an experienced veteran, would be anything by David Kirk. In particular is Phys Ed Futures book, and even though not an article, or his recent Precarity title, again, a book, but not an article. And maybe if we want the smaller version of the Precarity title, we would look at, chapter 8 of the Critical Pedagogy book by Pringle and his colleagues, Critical Research in Sport. That's a really good chapter that kind of sums up his Precarity title as well. And why I bring this up is, you know, he was pretty spot on with some of his predictions, and in particular 2020 with his Precarity title, and you know, some of the challenges that we're seeing in not only in physical education but in the K-12 sphere, the social emotional challenges, the precariat, as he brings it up, and the many unstable challenges that our local school community phases. And I think speaking to what Risto mentions about restructuring, I think the restructuring has to consider many of those challenges that Dr. Kirk foreshadowed.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, some of these future papers, they got a speed up during the pandemic of where we're going, what we're doing. It just kind of pushed some of those things much quicker. Mara, any comments on things that we are missing now that we should maybe be paying more attention to?
Well, something that I think this isn't particularly new, like I think it's certainly been addressed over probably years and years of this work, is the clearly notable disconnect between research and practice that you just highlighted when you were saying like how hard it is to find good high schools to place students at. And so it's like, we, if we look at the list of articles that we all just, you know, threw out as interesting or intriguing to us, like we see these, we know that some of these pedagogies work to engage students to demonstrate high level quality, meaningful PE. We don't see them in the school. We don't see them being done very much. And so that question of why and what's going on in PE teacher education that precludes new emerging, evolving ways of teaching, like why are we still like stuck in this sort of sport-centered curriculum that has been going on? I mean, I've been in the field 10 years for my first year of my doctoral program. We were talking about it then. It's been written about 10 years, 20 years, 30 years before that. And we're still trying to figure it out. So yeah. I feel like, to me, that is such a big one.
Yeah. And great point, Mara. I was on Clancy's New York State APERD podcast with Steve Silverman last night. And he said, Clancy asked a question of why would you suggest for somebody to read research, like a teacher? And Steve said, why would you start from scratch? Like, you have so much information already out there. Why would you start from the beginning? Because people have researched this. If you read the research, understand the research, implement the research, it will save you so much headache and time and effort. So I thought that was really well said. And I think that problem of transitioning the research into practice has been an issue. And Mara, that's a really good point to bring up. David, Oscar, and then Ben. So let's start with David.
Yeah, it's a point that resonates with what others have been saying on the call. But one of the things on a local level to Welsh health and physical education is one of the things I hope we don't miss is the opportunity for meaningful and sustainable change. And the actual idea of enacting some ambitious policies around health and health and well-being. And I just wonder if we look back in 10 to 20 years' time, whether we kind of look back at it and we've missed the opportunity for really supporting educators to make change at a local level, in the micro level of the classroom. And it comes to Mara's point in the sense that we've got some real ambition, we've got some real ambitious policies in Wales, I think, around health and health and well-being. And my observation is, how are we supporting educators to make that next transition? And one of the things is looking at ourselves in initial teacher education, physical education, teacher education, about what changes we're making. And I can't help but feel, you know, if we look back in 10 years' time, were we brave enough? Did we have those awkward conversations? Did we make ourselves uncomfortable enough to make those changes? And it's one that kind of plays on me a little bit.
Yeah,
I'll be honest. It's a really good question to be asking ourselves, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Oscar.
Well, I think one of the things that we can start looking at, especially now that technology has brought us together in so many levels, probably doing research in a more worldwide perspective, like especially with non-speaking English countries. Because one of the things that I've seen is that physical education is struggling so many levels, and it seems that PE has been struggling in similar ways in different countries. So if we kind of like establish like a network that we can understand how physical education is struggling in worldwide in so many ways, probably we can tackle, a problem that, or maybe go into a deeper understanding of how can we do as researchers, as a teacher, and provide a different perspective for our students as well. Because if we only do certain ways, we're going to keep doing the same. We're going to get the same results as Dr. Kirk said. So probably that's something we can do as well, especially using technology as we're doing it now, that we're in a different country, different time locations, and we're here. So probably we can take advantage of that and increase that perspective.
Yeah, I think, Oscar, you're spot on. And I think ICEP is starting to do a better job with this, of connecting those different countries and different researchers. And I know Ben, when he was part of that board, has pushed for the Developing Country Scholar to be able to get funding to go there. I think actually the push, which I don't like from a personal perspective, of these hybrid conferences and the access that, you know, if I'm going to a conference, I'm going to do a roundtable, I'm going to do it online instead of being in person with those people. It's not the best for the in-person experience, but the ability for that to be accessible to so many people around the world is great. And I think that, you know, in the US specifically, like we're very guilty of looking at research in only English, right? We look at it and it's like, this is the research that we know. Whereas there's a lot of Spanish scholars that publish only in Spanish that do really good work. There's a lot of people in Brazil that do good work that just doesn't get translated over. And so I think that, you know, when we do reviews or research, it should always have that caveat of saying, with this said, this is only English language articles. And I think that call, Oscar, is definitely something that we should be paying attention to. Ben, your hand went down, but are you good?
No. I would like to make a comment. Yep. Can you hear me okay, mate?
Yep.
Cheers. Look, I'd just like to reiterate what was just said. We funded 9 faculty from developing countries that otherwise wouldn't have attended ICEP. And if you go to these sessions, you just make sure aware of the good work they're doing in all these different countries in Africa or in Indonesia. Risto, how many people do you think live in Indonesia? I'm just, asking a quick...
There's...
About 250 million.
That was going to be my first guess. 250 million.
Yeah, mate. All right. Anyway, look, first of all, Risto, you should be, I just want to make a shout out to you, because you should be very proud of what you have accomplished with this podcast. And, you know, with this 200th episode, over 130,000 downloads, you've done a bloody good job, mate. All right. It's in Kiwi for you. I know our creative pedagogy seminar has now been downloaded over 10,000 times, as you've told folks. And, you know, many folks around the world who would otherwise not have access to this stuff, this critical, reflexive work that we're trying to do in pedagogy or curriculum or in any area of interest, otherwise would not be available. So, you know, you've made an excellent contribution to the field. So I'd like to give you a shout out. And before I start making a quick comment to connect with some folks. So, you know, I really like Jamie bringing up stuff on policy, and Jamie is in North Carolina, so we're going to hook up. And Mara, thanks for adding to that, and also talking about this theory practice gap. So Risto, I hope you don't mind that I'm going to just jump into, which was my future research question, which is how do we bridge this theory practice gap? So I think it's connected to a bunch of things people were talking about. So I hope you don't mind me fast forwarding a little bit with my comment. So in the schools, there are so many health and physical education people who are doing amazing work. And it's very tough work, it's very demanding, especially with COVID. And we should be working with these schools and with these communities to support and facilitate this high quality, creative and critical work that they're doing. So we have this age old dilemma that, you know, we in the ivory tower or disconnected tower, as Mara might call it, we have this knowledge and understanding that we should potentially facilitate this stuff, this work in the school. But, you know, a lot of emerging scholars are discouraged from going into schools. There aren't incentives. And so that is that the word, so they aren't going to do research in schools with kids or in the communities. And so this is also connected to our outdated TMP process. Our tenure and promotion, it rewards publications and grant writing and maybe a little bit of teaching on the side. So they need to be rewritten. So we need to work towards that. And I'm committed to doing that at UNC Greensboro. And I'll be talking to my folks about it as we're doing our strategic planning. But so that is connected to policy. But, you know, we just have this age-old problem where we struggle to work in the schools, and then we have this massive theory practice gap. So I'll leave it at that. Thoughts and comments about that are extending our work. I guess I'm trying to connect, you know, the lack of policy work at our own institutions, which then would help enable emerging scholars to work in schools. If we worked more in schools, which I really do think that we need to do in schools and in the community, then we would, that would certainly help facilitate reducing this theory practice gap.
Yeah.
I think that's enough. Cheers.
Thanks, Ben. And feel free to jump in and chime in. Let's go in order, though, with Kathy next, and then back to Kirsten. And Kathy, I will say thank you, because one of your students saw me at the conference this last weekend. We had the Vapored Conference, and she came up, she waited very politely, and then walked up to me and said, "Hi, are you so-and-so?" And my students are like, "Other people know you?" So you made me look like, or she made me look like a rock star in front of my five undergraduate students. So I really appreciate that.
Hey, happy to help. I wanted to congratulate you on the 200th episode and thank you for this amazing podcast, because I utilize it in my research methods class for FEET, and it's just an awesome resource for both in-service and pre-service and research, I mean, for everyone. Mara mentioned something that and Ben alluded to it as well, that made me think about what I think we're not paying attention to. And I feel like so many of our programs struggle to find appropriate placements for our student teachers. And so that lends me to think from the research and practice connection of, like, how is marginalization or, socialization, how is teacher socialization happening at the earliest level with our pre-service teachers? Like, when we send pre-service teachers into settings to do an 8-week or 12-week immersive, high impact student teaching experience, if we're sending them into a setting that is less than positive, mainly because of it's not developmentally appropriate best practice, then are we starting that socialization before they even get into the field? And how do we walk that line of conducting research to figure this out and to amplify the voices of those student teachers, to amplify the voices of those cooperating teachers? How do we walk that fine line without damaging relationships with the school systems and the schools? Because even if the practice isn't excellent, it's still a placement that you might want to keep, right? Yeah. And so how can we start to ask whether or not that's the early part of our bigger problem? Because we continue to see that we're having that same wheel continue to spin in terms of programs that are not developmentally appropriate. And so,
yeah. I think that
are
that's
we starting that process early?
Yeah. I think that's a good point. I mean, I changed my major in undergrad away from physical education to health science because of my field placement that I went to in a not great high school. Like, I went in and I observed it and I was like, I do not want to do that for a career. Like, there's no motivation for the students. That's not what I want to push through for the next, like, X amount of years in my career. And I changed to health science to be a health educator in the classroom. Now, obviously, that's come full circle, and I kind of see it in a different light. But I would have been that statistic in there that, Kathy, you talked about, of being placed in a place that wasn't great. Kirsten.
Just really appreciate everyone's comments, and I think one of the biggest challenges is it's going to sound problematic, but, you know, we are so entrenched and passionate about health and PE, and at the same time, we still operate where health and physical education is not valued in most settings. And so how do we partner with other educators and the settings we work in to get value? So, you know, I think we operate in silos way too often, and there's the ivory tower silo and the school silo, and there's the theory and the practice silo, and there's the research and the practitioner silo, and then we separate ourselves from other subject disciplines that might have real value. And I do worry, and maybe because I really focus on primary school settings, that it doesn't actually matter what I do in initial teacher ed. They go into a primary school where numeracy and literacy is far more valued than anything I will ever do. So, and the systems in those schools are going to privilege numeracy and literacy. So if I'm not partnering with those people, then it's a waste of time. Nothing I do in my courses will really shape change. So how do we work more smartly with our partners in education to bring about change, as opposed to just continuing to bang the HPE drum in isolation of the whole orchestra that is the system?
Yeah, I think that's so great. Yeah. I see this, you know, the silos, the, you know, we're not choosing to partner with certain organizations. And I think if you look at, you know, just how we're perceived, like if you look at STEM education in the US, there's a lot of like, get girls in STEM. Like there's all these like taglines and hashtags, and like a girl hashtag that, you know, I think was Dove or Nike or whatever, like they brand that. It has nothing to do with physical education. It has everything to do with sports and physical activity, but physical education and health haven't figured out how to partner with that to get that kind of elevated stature. Whereas other subjects, whether it's literacy, how, you know, different organizations are pushing literacy or numeracy or science education, haven't really been able to kind of bridge that gap, and I don't think PE has. And I'm not sure if I misinterpreted where you're going there or not, but care to?
Sorry, I realize my accent, but no, you didn't misinterpret. I think health and physical education, some of our objectives and goals can be delivered in conjunction with other learning areas. Yet we keep it as the siloed separate time, as opposed to a much more integrated thematic curriculum that extends across the learning areas.
Mm-hmm.
But we privilege it into this little patch of time. So we get our 50 minutes every, you know, twice a week, as opposed to going, actually, where is the connection between the learning? And how do we make use of those times to achieve collective agendas?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that even in New Zealand, the things that you're doing so much better than in the US is that community engagement of, like, at least it's written into that curriculum. And I don't know how it works in practice, but, you know, you do have that community aspect, and it is trying to at least bridge that gap, whereas it's not written in necessarily. I mean, into some shape standards, there's like, I think, one or two words like community in the entire K-12 connection. So let me, and I think this might be a little bit similar, of asking what future research questions should we be considering in the field. And, you know, I'll add two, not specific research questions, but areas. I think Mara brought this up, or somebody brought this up about recruitment and retention. Maybe not Mara, but anyway, I think that is one of the bigger things that we should be focusing on in the US is recruitment and retention, because if we don't solve that problem, then we don't have a field to actually work in and do research in. And, you know, in the US, especially, you know, compounded with this pandemic, teachers are done. You know, the teachers we talk to, they're just like 5 minutes away from quitting. Like, push me over the edge and I promise I'll leave, you know, like they're, the last 2 years have been really, really, really tough. And, you know, a lot of the greater like teacher education literature in general is showing that, you know, in the US, the tide has turned. There are more people, more parents who wish their kids not to go in to education as a career path. And, You know, I think there are very few programs in the US that are thriving, that are increasing numbers. I think most of my colleagues that I've talked to, there's a couple people, you know, a couple schools that participate in the Peak Collaborative that we run that talk about that they've increased. And honestly, like a lot of those places, other places will do the same exact thing, marketing and all of that, but not, they're not seeing that push. And the second one that I would love to see kind of expanded on internationally and outside of Australia is this idea of informal sport. Justin O'Connor has done a lot of really interesting stuff. He was on like 4 years ago. It's like one of my first podcasts that I did. And it just like lit up my imagination of what it could be. And these informal spaces, and how he talks about how you can participate in these activities like cycling alone or with two friends. You can participate in running, training for a marathon alone or with friends. You can do rock climbing alone or with friends. And it's like they're on these schedules that are not so rigid. And I think, you know, if we continue to push forward with football, basketball, softball, you know, lacrosse, these games that we need X amount of people, it puts it into such a rigid schedule that we are Tuesdays and Thursdays are practices, and then we play on Friday. Or if you really like hockey in the US, your ice time is from 10:30 to 11:30 p.m. and that's the time that you get to play ice hockey. And it's just not reasonable, and it's way more expensive as well. So those are the two kind of topics that I'd love to see kind of pushed forward. Other suggestions that where you would like to see more research or different types of research?
One of the things that I think is growing in terms of research in different ways is how we weave or acknowledge and respect Indigenous movement contexts in very Eurocentric programs. So it doesn't matter if we're talking Australia, New Zealand, US, we have a very, you know, most of our programs are based on what are called traditional sports, but they're traditional to who. Mm-hmm. And so a growing sense of the Indigenous people's play practices. I think there's growing literature on there, which is challenging for most people in ITE and in practice, because we don't necessarily see Indigenous communities as educators. So I think that will be an interesting place that we go, but that also means opening the doors and partnering with others again.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, ICEP did this in Banff, Canada. They tried to put a line of research about Indigenous research in health PE. And I mean, it didn't have a lot of submissions. There wasn't a lot of work there. And you look at the number of people in the US or, you know, even Canada, like doing research with Indigenous populations, and it's not a research line. And I think the US is so far behind in just public awareness of this. Like, I think, you know, New Zealand, Australia, much more progressive, and, you know, obviously has probably work to do, but they're much more forward thinking there. Other comments on future research or research ideas? Maybe you're protecting your own idea. You don't want to give your idea up so somebody steals it. Don't know.
To go back to what you were talking about the kind of work and meaning, I just did some similar work recently, which actually draws on the work that I saw Eamor Enright do in the University of Limerick, which Joanne was speaking about earlier, that article and that kind of stuff. And you know what we're finding with the students, like you talked about there, is that they are physically active, but they don't even realise it, and they don't ascribe that with you know, I suppose the stereotype or that's in or the expectancy of what it means to be physically active in physical education. I think that's something that people probably need to maybe consider going forward, is how, and I know that the Learning About Meaningful Physical Education group, or LAMP, are looking a lot into this kind of stuff about, you know, how do you embed like reflective practices into physical education. And I suppose that kind of stuff, it goes as a warning sign to teachers, because
they think if I'm spending time with students being reflective, well, then they're not physically active. Therefore, I'm not doing my job. Where I guess maybe what I've noticed in this point where I've had to move myself away from being that kind of teacher is that if you don't meet them where they are at that point and understand where they've come from, then it's very hard to try and, I suppose, create a sense of meaning around what it is to be physically active for them, because it does look like different things to different people. And that becomes a very loose kind of up in the air sort of thing when you think about what a curriculum should look like. But it's certainly something that, you know, Emer Enright did in her work with study, and the activists do, they study the embodiment of it for students. So, and I think that's something that we're still really missing in the field. And just to go back to one other point about the gap in research to practice, I think we talk about getting the research out to practice. For me, the biggest problem is getting the teacher to the research, because you can get it down onto the ground, but the teachers aren't willing to engage with it. I think that's a big problem. I know from my experience in Ireland, when I was about to graduate, Deborah Tannehill was said, no, just go out for a few years and see what it looks like, and come, and, you know, if you still feel you want to do research, then do it. And then I was lucky that I was able to become a teacher researcher in Ireland, and then subsequently find my way out in Greensboro. And then recently out here, I was trying to do some teacher researcher work, and unfortunately the school district wouldn't allow for it. So, I mean, there appears to be that gap for me, I guess, maybe in school districts in the US, where, you know, they're not comfortable allowing teachers to engage with research themselves or play around with it, which is something, of course, that you encourage a lot and promote a lot in your work here with the podcast.
Yeah.
And that's two things.
No, and I think that that's a good point there, because we don't... What does it do for the teacher? And I think that's the question that we need to ask as well, of like, when we go into a school and we have this really good idea... And I'm not saying that this is how you approach it, but I think there's a lot of researchers that go in with a research line, with an agenda, they present the idea and they go, this is what I want to do. And if the teacher's like, well, what does that help me? I mean, that was my dissertation. Like, I went in, I had an idea, it was top down. I got everybody to agree to participate. And yes, they got some like accelerometers and they got some different experiences and stuff, but now looking back several years later, I don't know if that was very like teacher directed, or I said that I was trying to value student voice, but in the end, I don't think I really did. And I think that it's tough. You have to be, because you can't also run a research line like that, you know, like saying, hey, what can we do? And we talked about this with Clancy yesterday, like, what would you like for me to do in this research? That also doesn't, you know, run a really like tight research line, which is again privileged in and important in research area. So go ahead.
And from a researcher perspective, Risto, I appreciate what you're saying, because I've tried to do that. You know, I've come in as the interventionist as well now, more so since I've been working with Ben. But you know, one of the important gatekeepers to get to those students is the teacher. And you know, we can't, if you're bypassing the teacher to get to the students, then you're missing, I suppose, a vital link there. The teacher is happy to stand back and allow you come in and do your thing, but it has to mean a little bit more. There has to be the teacher as well too, I think. But that's just a teacher researcher head and me playing around, but we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Hey Risto, can I just jump in on what Donald said?
Go ahead.
Okay, buddy. I think Donald's right that it's hard to enter the schools, and there's, you know, little sort of financial support or, you know, university support, as we talked about earlier, is very time consuming and so also labor intensive. But, you know, we can learn a great deal from being with the teachers. And so, you know, since I've got to Greensboro 3 years ago, you know, we've been able to get into schools. We are now in a elementary school where we have a student funded through the CARES Act, through negotiation with that school and with the CARES Act funding through the school. And Dernal has been able to work at middle college. And also another student has been able to work in the community, you know, with underserved youth at a Glenwood Community Centre. So there are, I guess I wanted to, you know, finish on a high note because I know time's running out, but there are high quality creative things going on out there. And I think we should recognize that as well. But I think we can't just sit back at our university and expect it to come to us. We have to get out there. We have to spend more time in the schools and more time in the communities. And, you know, Kirsten is exactly right. You know, having lived in New Zealand for 8.5 years and then coming back to the US, even Greensboro, which is one of the more diverse cities in North Carolina, you know, there is a massive difference between what is seen to be important. And, you know, when we do research in New Zealand, we invite the iwi, the tribe, to be part of it, or we invite the Ianga, the family from Samoa, to join in. In the US, we just go and do it. You know, we don't ask for permission. We don't spend time out there finding out who are the people who are the stakeholders within that community or within that school. And all I'd like to say is, if we did spend more time in schools and we did spend more time in the community, we'd figure that out better, and that would help reduce our theory practice gap. That would enable us to connect with the teachers in that context.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, eventually long term, we would create better policy. So,
yeah. And I agree.
Thank you, Risto, for doing it.
Yeah.
Cheers.
And our we did a review research on teaching PE, and we found that the vast majority of research in that area are questionnaires, and the population who is being studied is adults, and it's a lot of teacher education. So, you know, you're using the easiest method because you're so strained, right? Due to time. So you're using the easiest method, which is sending out a questionnaire via email, getting people to send it in. And your population is mostly pre-service teachers or adults, or a lot of team research, because you're going to get published through that team research, and that you're not going into schools because you don't have to get a consent form. You don't have to get access to schools. So, and I think that those are serious issues that we need to kind of figure out, because we don't want to go back to the what's going on in gym, like step into the black box kind of articles back in the 80s, 90s, where we weren't really going in and actually seeing what was happening. But let me go with David and then Jamie after that.
Thanks, Chris. There's some really interesting points there. I think one of them for me is linked to that, is about how can we keep pushing the kind of boundaries around co-constructing ideas with educators and young people. So one of my questions would be around what type of approaches can we use or are being used to support young people and educators in the co-construction of ideas and research within classrooms. That's not a new idea. I think Lawrence Stenhouse had some thoughts on that in the 70s, and you could probably go back a bit further than that around the idea of co-construction action research approaches. So some questions around that for me. And then linked to that was something I'm interested in and others have been interested in around the world, is around how do we support students and young people being more involved in the transformation of health and physical education. So how do we kind of accentuate their voice? How can we give them a more prominent role within that kind of policy enactment translation? And I think there's some questions around for me about giving them kind of knowledge and the skills to be policy actors themselves. I know Jamie talked about that earlier, but how can we support that with our graduate programs, undergraduate programs, and then also young people in schools as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Jamie?
I'm really not going to answer your question, which I think is not going to surprise you, but I think that one of the things around research and something that I've noticed, you know, kind of potentially, if I may, like moving into the middle of my career, I know I don't look like I could be in the middle of my career, you know, but I am. And I think that there's still sort of like this elitist attitude that exists like among different groups of researchers, that my research is more important than yours, or that this methodology is like what we should be doing. And I really just feel like, you know, in the vein of kind of like, can we just all get along a little bit better, that like there needs to be just a greater appreciation for the diversity of research that's happening and the different data that are being generated and the different questions that are being asked and answered. And I know for myself, like teaching PhD students has been, and PhD courses has been one of the most rewarding things because it's forced me to go back to literature that I wouldn't necessarily engage with for my own research purposes. And I end up reading things that I'm like, oh my goodness, why am I not reading more of this work and these types of things? And I think we get so stuck in our own little silos and our own little worlds with respect to that, that we would all benefit a little bit more from hearing from different voices, different perspectives. And so going back to the thread of kind of congratulating you on the podcast, I think that that's a really beneficial thing about something like what you're doing, because you do bring on diverse voices and diverse perspectives and people doing different types of work. And I think that if we could all just sort of listen to your podcast more, then maybe we'd all be a little bit better off from that perspective.
All right, you've earned your $10, or minimum wage, $15 an hour, $15 an hour. No, I think that's right, and I would agree. Teaching, like I teach a research reading seminar every other summer, and when I update that list of readings, that's what also pushes me to read out, you know, more current literature. And I think that, you know, I had Anthony Marr on a couple weeks ago, and he talked about how he reads a lot outside of the area of physical education, health education, and even like from disability research and stuff. And I think that those things are something that I could do a lot better on, and that would get a lot more kind of information. And you know, if you look at like ARA, you go to ARA, you just drop into any session. And for me, there's some sessions that I jump into and I'd be super confused because that's not something that's covered in the physical education research. And I feel like certain policy, like we talked about earlier, like you go into a policy session in education policy, it's light years in front of what we're doing in physical education, especially in the US. So I'll go ahead, Colin.
Iris, I just wanted to come in on that really as an example of something that I've been reading this weekend. It's a paper from one of my colleagues who's a sports scientist, worked in modern pentathlon. And what she and her colleagues did was they looked at the training load of modern pentathlon athletes. So these are young athletes, I think it was 12 to 16 years of age. And modern pentathlon is a strange sport because it involves running, swimming, cycling, fencing, and horse riding. And it was a really interesting paper to read because what they realized is that these athletes were doing up to 28 hours training a week, not including their physical education lessons. But what they also realized is that none of these coaches were really speaking to each other. So the swimming coach was saying we need to do more swimming, and the running coach was saying we need to do more miles, and the fencing coach wanted more practice. And I could only imagine what the PE teacher was then asking her, you know, we have to do 2 hours physical activity with the curriculum in on top of that. And I think it just really struck me as a paper that summarized the last two points. I think it was David's point about the need to involve learners, because they only found out that the young people were doing this by giving the learners an app, constructing an app and letting them record it and talking to them and doing focus groups and also focus groups with the parents. So the importance of listening to the young people to understand their whole week and their whole lives rather than just looking at a single activity in isolation. But also, it struck me as that last point of, you know, reading outside the PE and sports coaching literature, it's really a sports scientist paper.
Yeah.
So I'll put it in the chat, but I think it kind of gives examples for those two points, is for us to maybe go beyond our boundaries a little, but also, as David said, we've got to involve the learners. And I think that's maybe something we need to do more as we move forward to understand their journey. So I thought it was a good example of the last two points. I hope it helps people. I'll put the paper in the chat.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I think that Go ahead, Dominique.
Well, it just made me remember, and I sound old, but Larry Locke used to have this thing in JTPE saying, here's what you're missing if you don't read outside of this journal. And so he was doing that, again, 30 years ago. And I think that it's just good to reiterate this. And to the point of asking the kids, the greatest, we published a paper recently, and we had 50 copies, and that was a paper that asked, you know, kids what they do in terms of physical education and physical activity, and that's the most popular paper. I mean, those papers were gone within days, those free copies. So there is an interest, but the work that it took to get that data was tremendous. Getting the parents to sign those release forms, getting the schools to agree to let us in. So all that process is cumbersome. So, and therefore, it is for older people like me and now you, Risto, now that you're tenured, that can afford to do this kind of research. Because the pressure of publishing, you know, to get tenured is still good. It's still great to get full professor, but not as great. And so, in a way, it takes kind of this next generation. They have to rely on us to get some of that policy work and that research with the kids done.
And think about longitudinal research. Like you would.
Yes.
I wouldn't say. I think you'd be misguided if you started a longitudinal study as a first or second year assistant professor with a 4 or 5 year longitudinal study. I mean, it would be great to start early, but you're not going to publish those papers. And I think that that's good research to do a longitudinal study, but you can't really pick it up until you get past certain hurdles in the tenure and promotion process. So I think you bring up a really good point. At this point, I mean, I think Clancy and I could hang out for another 2 hours, but let me just kind of open up the questions for the last couple questions. I especially want to highlight the last one. What good things do you see happening in our field? And this is a nod to conversations I've had with David and Joanne about appreciative inquiry, which is a project that I still really want to do, because I feel like looking at the good in the field and understanding that, yes, there are things for us to critique and there's plenty of research that critiques things, but going in with a lens of looking at something positive, I feel like that's something that we should at least bring into this conversation. And the other questions of, you know, if you want to chime in about the future, like what do you envision the future of health and physical education and being, and maybe we can kind of not immediately close out, but start closing out on those questions. So I'll put my two out here about what good I see in the field is that there's a lot of very passionate grad students, and I know Donal, is one of those. I think Alba Rodriguez, who's our grad student, you can see that they're very engaged. They're starting new things. They're collaborating with each other. And I feel like seeing that is really nice. You know, the ARA conference is coming up here in April, and there was a huge presence of doctoral students. And I know, Ben, you had a really good run this year in your doctoral students who were submitting to ARA Sig 93. So props to UNCG, man. Like you all are doing really well and really good stuff coming out of that group. So and a lot of your former students are publishing in that conference as well. So I love seeing that passion. You know, speaking back to ARA, the highest ranked paper in the last, let's say out of the last 10 years, the highest ranked paper that comes out just by numbers, I'd say at least 70% of the time is a graduate student. And so out of everybody who's putting that in, it's always interesting And it's, you know, Anchi Chen, who is out of UNCG now in a postdoc position. You know, she's won the, you know, she won the award last year for best doc student. And it's basically whoever scores the highest out of all the doctoral students. But she scored highest out of everybody. And I think that those are really, really cool things to see when there's really great grad students coming up. And the other thing that I really like seeing is this focus on student voice and student choice and working with students. And I want to kind of give highlight Carla Ligueti's work here. I think she's putting out a tremendous volume of stuff. Like, I feel like every time I go on Twitter, Carla's got a new paper out. But she's doing great work, and I like that that she's working with different sports organizations and different youth groups. So other things that you see that are great in health and physical education. Donal, go ahead.
Yeah, no. One cool project I did was I started looking at how democracy was written about in physical education over the last 100 years. I presented that at SHAPE last April. I call it a democratic pursuit of meterism in physical education, which is a bit lofty, and I don't think a teacher would read it. But all I'll say is that we've never done a better job of some of the things we're doing in physical education right now, and to keep the glass half full. And, you know, especially in relation to the topic I was writing about, which was democracy and social justice, which is stuff that I'm interested in, and I really only scraped the surface compared to a lot of people you just mentioned there. But when I was listing out people like Hemphill, Blackshear, Cust, I started running out of breath. So the people are out there, they're all over the world, and they are doing great work, you're right. And it's just a reminder that, you know, to do your best, even if the best isn't necessarily you can realize where that is or what that's going to look like by the end that you get there, but you keep doing that. And I think in the field we're doing a really exceptional job of that, especially in the last 10 years. And you look at the type of literature, especially in higher education anyway, that does need to trickle down. But definitely it's very hard to go a week without seeing an article about some of the great topics that we talk about, and without seeing a podcast that you are sharing this work as well too. It's very hard to go without something cropping up recently. So yeah, glass half full, definitely.
Yeah, thanks for that. And Donal, I'd recommend going into the chat there and chatting with Nate. Get his email address, Nate Babcock, on there. I know I his camera's off, but I saw a light bulb go up above his head when you said democracy in physical education. And he talked in the chat about meaningful physical education and how great it is seeing that coming up and being, I mean, There's a whole session on social emotional learning, and a lot of that stuff has the meaningful physical education coming up in ARA as well. So, and Nate will be in San Diego, so just a quick train ride for you. David, what good do you see?
Well, aside from your podcast, Risto, really good.
How could I transfer money over to your account for the $15 bonus and the free plug?
We'll sort something out. No, seriously, I think podcast is great. I think my students really, really engage with it. And the teacher educators in Wales have really found it useful as a way of accessing a whole range of ideas and perspectives, and really showing them that actually as a community, there is diversity there. I think there's a long way to go with diversity of ideas, but I think things like this really help that process. So, aside from your podcast, I just get a sense over the last few years that there's a real sense of our community being willing to try and enhance itself, to have more active dialogue across different spaces. I think, aside from being unable to travel, the use of technology has allowed us to talk more and more frequently, and I think that's a really good thing to see, and I think that's really shown how many different ideas and approaches are being taken, but ultimately trying to do the same sort of thing, which is to enhance young people's experience of physical education and physical activity. So I think that's really good. I think that's a really positive thing for the future. And also then the other good thing, as kind of Donald's talking about there, is some of the quality of the ideas and the work that's being published in the journals. I think you know, my reading list is longer than my ability to read them out of mind, which is always a real good thing to have going on. But I think some of the ideas and the quality of the writing is really, really exceptional in places.
Yeah, and I do agree with you that international, like being able to, with technology, work across different time zones. And I will give a free plug out to worldtimebuddy.com. Great website. You just type in, all right, Cardiff, let's go with Melbourne, let's go with Virginia, and then you could just like figure out exactly what that time zone is. And it actually took in daylight savings time for this, so I'm happy that it worked, because you could go through and actually put the specific date, which is the date we're recording. And that's the thing, like through technology, that's how I met David. Like, that's how I met you. You came on the podcast, we talked. Now, you know, we're working on a paper together and working across a bunch of different time zones. And I think that that's so cool to be able to do that. Clancy.
I'm glad that Nate brought up the meaningful PE framework. I think that's an excellent point. And then Donnell's mention about democratic perspectives when it comes to the future of physical education. I think that's critical. And I think David speaks as well to what we've learned even from the pandemic. I think even though we have the pandemic and a lot of the challenges from the pandemic, but we have, you know, obviously mixed feelings, but at the same time, we've learned the value of quality health and PE and the well-rounded education of each child moving forward. And I think that's a lesson that many school districts have learned as a result of that. So I think that's promising, and I hope we can continue to fight the challenge ahead when it comes to making sure that physical education and health has its rightful place in the K-12 sphere. You know, other promising things are, again, the continued advocacy for our profession by way of some of the outstanding professionals here today as well. You know, I know Steve Harvey and Colm, you know, have done a lot of research that segues teaching to coaching and how there are a lot of universal principles that apply. And I think by doing that, Colm is, you know, interested in that notion of care and how care is so important in any profession that we undertake. But also, you know, Steve's hard work when it comes to relaying and disseminating the pedagogical principles that are successful with coaching that come and originate from teaching and physical education. I think that only strengthens the profession moving forward to see its value when it comes to outside constituents.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there is a big transition there, that those coaching and teaching is overlapping. I know Shane Pill and a bunch of others are, they just published a book on the spectrum of coaching styles, which is super interesting. Yeah. And they said that they've
Shane
gotten...
and how could we forget Shane, Richard Light, all of those. They're doing wonderful work and relaying, again, that nexus between coaching and teaching. That's the critical piece. And I think it only strengthens the value of our profession by doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. Any final thoughts, burning questions for the field from the people on here? And that's how you end a online lecture right there in class. Hearing none, the class is over. I really appreciate everybody that came on. And again, if you're listening, really appreciate all the listenership here as well. It has been a really fun ride over the last 4 years, and doing weekly episodes for four years and only missing like 2 or 3 weeks, I feel like that was kind of an accomplishment that I did not sign up for. I didn't think it was going to go like this, but it's been fun, and I love talking about different topics. I know that, you know, the article club that we run once a month, we're going to start moving towards more, not every week, but more towards out of our area to kind of push our reading and thinking. And so if those are things that you're interested in, or you want to start an article club to read certain things, or if you have a book idea that you want to kind of read a book together and get on and kind of talk about it, I'm definitely interested in that. I think this is a good platform for creative and different thinking stuff. So it doesn't have to be this way. And I know that, you know, a full acknowledgement of how this started, I was trying to get these podcasts to be 20 to 25 minute long podcasts so they could be quick, easy, like listening before students go to class. But it's definitely morphed into this like 45 minute to an hour conversation with one scholar or two scholars at a time. And to be honest, I don't hate that. I enjoy it. I think it's a good conversation. We get to really unpack the paper. But you know, if there's ways that you all that are listening that think that this could improve, like I'm super open to feedback on how to make this more you know, more approachable for people listening and helpful. So trying to do some short ones and some longer ones, and obviously if you're still listening, it's like an hour and a half in, and you're like, these are not 20, 25 minute podcasts, but we had a great time, and thanks everybody for listening. If you're still listening, you're probably really into health and physical education. So I'm going to use this opportunity to pitch our master's program to you if you don't have your master's degree yet. Our 100% online master's degree program we offer at George Mason is affordable. You can do it while teaching, and it's high quality. Mason was listed as one of the top 50 universities under 50 years old in the world. Our education department was ranked in the top 10 nationally for the online master's degree program in curriculum and instruction. The master's degree revolves around your teaching. So you'll use assignments from the classes to immediately apply research and best practices to your classes. You'll be part of a tight-knit cohort of health and physical education professionals who are passionate about teaching. You're also going to get an opportunity to interact with students in other content areas. So if you're interested, you can email me, look me up on Twitter, or you can go on the hpewebsite.com under Study With Us and watch a video that I've made.